Cordon up theater people, and welcome to a special series of Your Program Is Your Ticket, coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, right in the middle of Broadway. My name is Sean Chandler, and I'll be your host. Your Program Is Your Ticket is a discussion of smaller theater works and the people and organizations that make it happen. As many of you know, Your Program Is Your Ticket is a helpful system where your program is literally your ticket to get into the theater in smaller, more intimate productions. It's these works we like to highlight, and it's our goal on this show to feature as many of these productions as possible while still discussing the biggies. I love theater and see as much as I can wherever I go. During the travels of the production of my husband and my play, At the Flash, I've met many wonderful people from all over the world in the theater community, and it is my honor to bring them on as guests to the show. Tonight's show is part 6 of a special series of interviews for the 2018 Frigid Festival here in New York City. Founded in 2007, Frigid is an open and uncensored theater festival that gives artists an opportunity to let their ingenuity thrive in a venue that values freedom of expression and artistic determination. I recently had the honor of sitting down with a superb, passionate artist within the Frigid Festival to speak with them about their individual shows, their wonderful experience with Frigid Festival, and their overall thoughts on theater itself. My guests on this episode are Zachary Stamp and Tony Stamp, their brothers, from Life in 60 Minutes, Kelsey Herks from Can't You Tell, and Marissa Stefatos and Rafi Frungian from Upstander Bystander from Camp to Camp. Together, they consist of a song cycle musical, a play with music, and a smart comedy. What a great combination. Now, quick note, as you listen, you may hear some minor differences in audio. These interviews were recorded at separate times and locations. Not that that takes any of the enjoyment out of the experience of these fabulous artists. Just letting you know in case the sound feels a little different from one interview to the other. So folks, without further ado, please enjoy interviews with Zachary Stamp and Tony Stamp from Life in 60 Minutes, Kelsey Herks from Can't You Tell, and Marissa Stefatos and Rafi Frungian from Upstander Bystander from Camp to Camp. Folks, please welcome to the show Zachary Stamp and Joey Stamp from the show Life in 60 Minutes. Hi, Zachary and Joey, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. How's it going with you?
It's going very well.
Good. We're knee-deep in rehearsals right now.
Absolutely. Working our butts off every evening.
Wow. Yeah. As it goes. Now, you guys are brothers.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay, we're missing one brother in the equation. Yes. And who's that?
That's Michael Stamp.
Yeah.
We all grew up together in Waterloo, Iowa, where our parents got us into theater at a very young age.
Cool.
So we are all musically inclined, we're all musically talented, and that's what we're doing in this production. I'm playing guitar,
I'm playing the drums, and Michael's playing the piano. So we have our own little band we put together.
I'm intrigued. I am. So let's get into it. Tell our audience about Life in 60 Minutes.
Basically, I am a person. I struggle with drugs and alcohol.
Okay.
I struggle with addiction. So as a part of my healing process and recovering process, I decided to write a show. And since I've been into music, I'm a musical performer. That's the best way that I knew how to do it, was to write 10 songs and sort of stream them together with the narrative. Joe helped with the writing and the narrative. But the core story is about me and my struggles with addiction. I'm also a veteran. I was in the United States Marine Corps. That's where a lot of the mental health issues come into it, but it's been a tremendously healing process. And what's really cool is I'm able to do it with the two people I grew up with, and we all play music together. So it's touching, it's very meaningful, and overall I think it's a very important project nowadays, especially with the opioid epidemic that's happening in the country with addiction.
We feel like the show is coming at a relevant time because there seems to be a large opiate addiction problem that is kind of sweeping the country. And while we don't have any, you know, solutions, we wanted to start a dialogue at least. And the show is a true story based on Zach's experience. That's why it's called Life in 60 Minutes. It's his life up till now. And it's really just an honest show. And doing it as brothers has been a really intriguing process because we want to do it well. We want to tell the story well, but we have to kind of separate ourselves because of some of the things that Zach has been through.
Sure.
It's just been hard because it's someone you really care about going through these things you don't want anybody to ever have to go through. And it's been a really good process for us as brothers. I think it would be hard for a group of friends to do this kind of show. Because there's just an unspoken chemistry that we have from growing up together.
Oh, definitely.
And having that, just even as an artistic process, is so freeing because you can give and take and not be worried about opinions and egos. You can just be like, no, your idea is stupid. I'm like, yeah, you're right. My idea is stupid.
That's happened on multiple occasions.
But it's been a great process.
It's been
so
very
far.
Good. It's been very good.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, congratulations on dealing with this. It's not an easy thing to deal with.
Yeah.
And what a great way to express that. And always keep it in the forefront, mm-hmm. which I think is necessary for people who are in recovery from alcohol and drug addiction. It's always remembering
right.
that, and we'll probably and we'll definitely help many many people. So break down the writing. Who wrote what in the show?
Well, basically, I wrote the 10 songs, because there's 10 individual pieces that we perform as a rock band. Mm-hmm. And some of these pieces I started writing when I was like 8 or 9 years old and never really knew. They're just themes get stuck in my head. And some of these I wrote specifically only for the show. So it was having these 10 songs from my life that I had been working on. It's interesting because it adds to the history. I don't know. It kind of goes along with telling the story. For example, there's a part where after I get out of a mental institution, I sort of stopped giving a shit about anything. And, mm-hmm. and I wrote a song around that time called I'm Not the One, and I'm not going to relive the whole song right now, but basically it's about not giving a shit about life and just doing whatever feels good.
Now, is that in the current version of the show?
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, exactly. So
because we feel it really represents a time in his life, and each song kind of serendipitously represents a time in his life and a checkpoint of where he was and where he has been, and it's been great to kind of have those, because then once he wrote those songs, he gave them to me, mm-hmm. and I kind of helped put a narrative together,
great.
In a sort of a timeline for the show. And that's been our process. We've produced films and some other theatrical productions, and our process has always been like Zach kind of gets the raw idea, yeah. I take it, turn it into a script,
exactly.
and then we produce it.
It's very much left brain, right brain, where I'm sort of the muse, but I am not good at the follow through, and then Joe comes in and cleans up. Well, this doesn't make any sense.
Well, a musical, for the most part, and I would assume this is either a musical or it's at least a song cycle.
Yeah, no, that's actually a really good way to put it, because it's 10 songs and the narration ties them together in the middle, and there's a little bit of the projector used with that multimedia.
Yeah, there's some multimedia involvement. I would say it leans more towards a song cycle,
right?
And because the narrative is really his life, mm-hmm. But there's no like scenes or dialogue necessarily.
Well, it needs to be collaborative.
Yes.
Even a song cycle, because I've just written one, it's still a big job.
Yeah.
And you need lots of different points of view going into it. I would assume that do the songs vary in style?
Yes, absolutely.
What styles do you cover?
Well, we've definitely got rock. We definitely have, especially when we were growing up in the late 90s, early 2000s, that was a lot of our formative years of collecting music. So there's a lot that kind of sounds like Simple Plan or Blink 182, and then there's a little bit more that sounds more like Sublime, and then there's almost classical piece. It varies a lot, but definitely towards rock and alternative.
And I would say there's a lot of our parents' musical influences in it, yeah. as well.
Yeah.
Like our parents were very big into the Beatles and Van Morrison, and so that style of music you can hear in ours, like mm-hmm. honky tonk, blues. Even there's one song that has like hints of reggae, in that just sort of musical style.
Yeah.
That's excellent.
Yeah.
Now, you say you grew up in Iowa.
Yes.
And you grew up in a musical theater family, or an artistic family.
Very much so, yes.
Surprisingly.
What was it like growing up in Iowa in an artistic family? What was that? Talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think we are incredibly fortunate because we grew up in what's now is the Black Hawk Children's Theater or the Waterloo Community Playhouse. It's a smaller town compared, especially compared to New York, but it was a place that we really could be ourselves and be creative, and we're allowed to. We never felt strange or like outcasts.
Sure.
I mean, that was very formative. That was really good to have for us as a resource when we were children.
And our parents never discouraged us from pursuing these things. They always were like, I don't know, they encouraged us to pursue music and pursue arts.
Exactly. They had us starting piano lessons when we were very young, and the only rule was is look, you can still take any kind of music lessons. It doesn't have to be piano, but you have to take music lessons. You have to be striving towards something creatively, because we had all done fairly well on the standardized testing in schools, you know, up until high school when everyone becomes a dick. But before that, we were doing fantastic.
Well, a good majority of people. Until life kind of kicks our butt a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The first tasting of what being an adult is.
But our parents just really pushed, not, they didn't push us, but they encouraged us to, to pursue these things we were interested in. I had a very strong love of film at a young age, and they helped get us a camcorder, and we have some home videos we made that will make an appearance in this show in a really emotional way.
And it's actually kind of creepy. Some of them are alluding to future events, and just watching, just because I'm saying something about rehab when I'm like 9 or 10 years old, and I'm like, well, now that I've been there.
Wow. How prophetic.
Exactly.
Wow.
It's creepy.
So we have this treasure trove of these old videos that we made, and we have found a really powerful way to interweave them into the show, and just to show audiences a juxtaposition, I'll say. I don't want to give away too much of what it is, but it's we handle some hard topics, and we use our childhood as a way to talk about those topics.
Individually, give me a couple of adjectives or sentences about how writing this changed you. I want to see your different perspectives, you being in it, you experiencing it.
Well, for me, I'm going to try not to get too emotional, but for me, at the time, I was really struggling with sobriety and being sober. So this really helped me work through a lot of that stuff, and it really helped me kind of put a perspective, a reframe events, not necessarily like, wow, I can't believe I lived through that, but more so, this, if this wouldn't have happened, I wouldn't be where I am today, and I wouldn't, you know, I have an awesome girlfriend I'm living with, I have great brothers that I can, you know, pursue artistic things with. So for me, it was really good to just sort of see this from an outside perspective, but also deal with some dormant emotions that were still in those events. And now I'm at a much better place than I was when I first started writing this.
Not to make this about me, but just so you know, I have been sober since 1989.
Wow,
and I went through I went through 2 years of outpatient rehab. And I'm only sharing this because I know it can be it can be really difficult.
Yeah.
But I look back on that time now with a lot of perspective because I'm twice your age. and I think I'm so glad that that happened.
Yeah.
That flipped my life in so many ways, and also flicked a switch in my life to where things got real. And they got real in a good way.
Exactly.
And it was like, it was such a blessing to have that. So there is no shame in crying. There's no shame in feeling what you're feeling. It's great. Okay, I'm going to stop playing therapist. Move over to the
$50 copay.
It's okay.
I think for me, it's I've never been through anything like this. I don't struggle with addiction. So to me, it's just been eye-opening in humbling to understand this perspective. And I'm just more of a quiet listener because I want to help him tell this story. I don't want to put my voice into it because my voice doesn't have anything to add to this. I want to help strengthen his voice because I just haven't gone through this. But I recognize that Zach has, and a lot of other people have. And so that's why it's important for me to tell this story.
Were there any moments where you felt a darkness within you or a dread in going to these places that you had to go to because you're dealing with your brother here? This isn't you co-writing with somebody from school. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, that can have its own dynamics, but but this is very close.
Yeah, I think we did a small preview production at our home theater in Waterloo, which was very emotional because everybody in the audience grew up with Zach. And I think that was the hardest time for me to watch the show because we were surrounded by people who knew us and appreciated the journey that Zach had been through. And that, for me, I think was the time when I was able to kind of see the darkness and recognize it and just observe it and understand it, I think.
A moment of empathy.
Yeah, yeah. And a moment of empathy and understanding. Because it's so easy to dismiss people who have struggled with addictions. It's just, a lot of times the dialogue is, well, just stop, just quit, as if it's that easy.
Right.
And it's just not. And I see that now, and I understand that now, that it's not easy. It's a bear that's on your back that is with you for life. So.
It's, as they say, cunning, baffling, and powerful.
Yeah.
For sure. So, okay, so I've taken you to an emotional place. Let's reel it back. How are rehearsals going for the show, for this particular production?
They are, we give a little hard time at the beginning, but it's actually a lot of fun. We practice in the basement of the house I'm staying in Brooklyn, so we make lots of noise. We do not go before noon, we do not go after 8 p.m., but it's mostly been music rehearsals. It's mostly been the three of us jamming and coming up with, the songs are written, but it's every time we play the songs, it's almost like there's, oh, wait, that was cool, stop. Can you do that again? Especially Michael, the one who isn't here, the piano player, he's probably the best musician out of the three of us. Oh, he's actually trained. So whenever he does something new, it's I don't know how to read music. I play by ear. So when he does something new, I'm like, can you do that thing again? He's like, what thing? I go, the da-na-na-na-na. And he's like, I don't know. What is that? What is that da-na-na-na?
Right.
Like, I don't know how to say the things I'm hearing. So, but it's been really cool. It's been a really cool process, the rehearsal so far.
Zach talked earlier about our influences of the 90s and early 2000s. And it really feels like that sort of garage band era when we're in the rehearsal room, because we're in this basement that is not, it's not clean.
Oh, it's dingy.
It's a place to rehearse.
It's great. I love it. Yeah.
And it just feels like, you know, a garage band.
Yeah.
And our collaboration is just, we've known each other our whole lives.
We've been playing music with each other our whole lives, pretty much.
Yeah, our dad made us learn music together at a very young age.
Honestly, he just wanted people to jam with.
He wanted them to play.
He loved to play music. He just wanted people to jam with. He was busy.
He made his own band.
He made his own band.
Well, and I applaud your parents. Are you willing to tell me your parents' names?
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. David Stamp and Linda Stamp, and they are both still in Waterloo. They sold the family house, have an awesome apartment now because rent's there. Is about $5 a month.
And now that
if only, right?
And now that we're all...
Now you're going to make me cry.
And now that Zach and Michael and I are all living out in New York, they've been talking about moving out here for their retirement.
Oh, geez.
To be closer to us.
They know it's not going to be $5.
No,
they're looking at New Jersey. Okay. A little bit more affordable.
Yeah. That still could be rolling, but anyway.
No, for sure.
That's so amazing. And they're smart because having indoctrinated you into music at an early age, it's helpful. Even if you're not a full-on master musician, you understand the language.
Exactly.
You can speak the language to each other.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
My fiance right now is learning the ukulele, and she has said jokingly that she wishes someone had forced her to learn this at a younger age so she would know it now. And I've
heard that a lot, especially after I'm done playing a song. Like, in a public setting, it's like, man, I was taking piano, I wish we would have stuck with it. I'm like, you still can. Nothing's
never
right?
Just,
nothing's stopping you. YouTube tutorials, are you kidding me? Now to learn an instrument?
When we were kids, practicing was like, oh, gotta practice. Yeah. But now that we are adults, we
thank God we practice.
Wow. Yeah. What has your experience been like with FrigidFest?
It's been very positive. It's been very cool so far. I'm really looking forward to, there's something coming up the 13th that's called Snapshots. But basically, it's where a lot of the shows themselves get to go and do an open mic sort of thing.
Excellent.
And so, I'm not sure. I don't think they have a location yet for it. But I'm really looking forward to it because we have some friends in the, because the indie theater world in New York is a surprisingly small place sometimes. It's a small world where you'll run into the same people. So we have some friends that have productions this year. And they're going to see ours. We're going to see theirs. It's a really cool community. community to be a part of.
It's been great. And they've been very supportive. They help. I mean, they set this up for us, and they've helped set up a lot of other opportunities for us. Mm-hmm. When there is decreasingly less and less opportunities for artists at our level.
Oh yeah, and indie art, especially with Netflix. I mean, as much as those now, you get those mid-range artists that are able to make more of a living out of it. It's sort of pushing the independent art. That's how it feels. I'm not sure. You know, that's how it is, but it just feels there's less opportunities for independent artists. So you have to go and really make your own opportunities, and Fridge is doing a great job in supporting indie art.
Indeed. I totally agree with you.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you made that statement about creating your own opportunities. In my regular show, I ask people, what is the one thing that an artist can do, a director, actor, composer, musician, whatever, to be successful and have the competitive advantage. And 90% of the time, they say, create your own opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
They say, take responsibility for your career.
Yep.
Don't let anybody else hold it in their hand.
Yeah.
You're still going to hear no a lot. I've had a play and a musical produced. I still hear no all the time. So, but at least you feel like you're somewhat in control.
Yeah.
And that's a good feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
and one of the plus sides about how strong media is right now is that there are elements of it that's becoming more affordable for people like us.
Mm-hmm.
We recently produced a film called 17 that has been featured in the New York Short Film Festival and is going to be featured in the Indie Horror Film Festival in DeKalb, Illinois.
Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah. And we were able to shoot that entire film on a budget of like $1,000.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's a short film, but we feel it's our strongest film so far.
Absolutely. That's another one thing is when folks get out of college or art school or whatever and they think they're going to go make, you know, Titanic. They think they're going to go do this next thing. You're going to make a lot of bad art, and then you're going to make some decent maybe art, and that's kind of the stage we find ourselves for film anyways. And I mean, it's just work.
This way.
You have to put in the work.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's funny when people... when somebody gets famous, you're just seeing the famous version of that person. You're not seeing the decades and the years, even if they're a young person. Some people have been at it since, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, making it. So I get that.
Yeah, yeah.
As somebody who didn't have really any success until I was like 45.
Still new to the scene.
Right. Yeah, here I am, a baby heart. Now, before we go, give our audience the social media information for the show, please.
So our Facebook is called Stamp Productions. You can find us at facebook.com/StampProductions.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
And that's where all of our social media is right now.
So the audience can go to that and they can connect to anything else that you have. And you have Twitter and...
We're not there yet. Our social media wing is still growing.
Yeah.
But everything we have, our films, our plays, it's all on our Facebook.
On Facebook. Yeah. That's actually very smart. It's very consolidated. Mm-hmm. So, well, thank you, Brother Stamp, Zachary, and Joe. You guys were a terrific interview, and I wish you... broken legs, but not broken arms, because you need your arms to play your music. So.
You can haul us around. It's
right, exactly. It sounds like a wonderful, edifying experience in theater, and I'm super excited, and I really hope I get a chance to see it.
Absolutely.
I really
fantastic.
Do. So, great job, and thanks again.
Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Folks, please welcome to the show Kelsey Herks from Can't You Tell. Hi, Kelsey, and welcome to your program, Is Your Ticket.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure to have you on the show. Now, you've written a show called Can't You Tell.
Yes.
Can you tell our audiences all about Can't You Tell?
Yes, I can. It is a queer romp set in the 1920s about a bunch of artists up in Harlem.
Wow.
if I flatter myself, it's sort of in the vein of Noel Coward, Manor's Place.
How did you come up with that idea?
Well, I have been to a lot of cool and interesting parties, and I've met a lot of interesting people. I'm just really interested in history as well, and I really like telling stories about LGBTQ characters in historical settings, especially stories where no one dies. It's a low bar, I know. Well, but
I don't mean to laugh, but that takes me by surprise. And yet it's just so right.
Well, we've always existed, even if our stories have not been told.
Exactly. And it's so often that there's a tragic,
yes,
traumatic ending. And it's nice that somebody is putting the LGBTQ into themes, into a play that are positive.
Yeah, everyone's having a great time. They're all at a party. Hijinks ensue. There's definitely conflict, but no one dies. There's no one has a horrible disease or is forced to marry or something. It's all just people the way that I know people.
Wow. Now, did you personally get a little worn out in seeing that those types of themes in plays and in movies?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was 15, I think, I saw Morris, the Merchant Ivory film.
Uh-huh.
And I was actually surprised that no one died at the end. And I remember, and like that feeling of surprise then took me by surprise, because I was like, well, why would I expect them to die? Like, why shouldn't they have a happy ending? And there are so many reasons. Like, I could go all into the 60s pulp novels and like stories about lesbians and how they had to be censored. Someone had to die or get married in order for them to get published. I could go into how the only records we have about queer people are lawsuits and tragedy. But the fact is, there were people living normal, happy, fun, weird lives always. We just didn't get to hear about them.
Do you think that that is because oftentimes LGBTQ material had to put the struggles at the forefront when it came to art and movies and films, so that we could break barriers and boundaries?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't fault any of the creators of those other pieces.
Right.
Like, even Morris, the one that I referenced earlier, it wasn't published until years after Ian Forster died, because it couldn't be. He just wrote it for himself.
Uh-huh.
And there were actual queer people writing those pulp novels in the 60s, and like, yes, they had to write a character that died or got married at the end, but they were able to write a relationship, like maybe, sure, they knew once, you know. So I don't fault them. I do not fault those creators, but I know that we're past allegory and subtext now. We can have full, rich, happy characters.
Wow, that's a great, I don't want to call it a mission or a goal, because, I mean, that might be your mission as an artist,
mm-hmm,
but I'm sure that the, that Can't You Tell is, it doesn't have a mission, does it? Does it have more of a message to it?
I personally, I feel that as a playwright, I don't get to say what that is. I think that's
really
up to, yeah, I know it. I know other writers, again, I don't fault them. It's just different. I believe that theater is inherently collaborative, and that is what I love about it. Every person involved, every actor, the director, every designer is an artist in their own right. And if I want it to just say one thing, then that's imposing my art on everyone else's art. And I'm not interested in doing that. I'm interested in what is created that is so much greater than any one of us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really know what it's quote unquote about or saying. I think it's about what every character thinks it's saying, and then the director thinks it's saying, and then every audience member thinks it's saying. I just wanted to tell a story about people at a party, maybe sniping at each other, maybe lifting each other up, maybe confessing love, maybe fighting a little bit, maybe doing some crazy, crazy hijinks. I just wanted to tell a story about people that I thought were interesting that I would want to meet at a party.
Wow. I personally, I think that good writing breathes. I think that it allows for people, if there is a piece of theater that can be played four or five different ways and interpreted a multitude of ways, that's great writing, because then it could be done over and over and over with different visions. So I think that that is an excellent philosophy, and I completely applaud you for it. Talk about some of the characters in the show.
Yeah, sure. So we've got, they all kind of fall into, I'm obsessed with history, they all kind of fall into these like 1920s tropes. So we've got the American writer and his wife and their German boyfriend that they share, and her ex-girlfriend who is a French poet who picked up a chorus girl from a party at Harlem.
Oh,
and
wow.
They're all at their friend, well, Eliza, who's the wife, they're all at William's Harlem studio because he just got dumped, and they're bringing him a party even though he's down, you know, he just needs some fun times.
So it sounds like there's a lot of sort of fluidity with the sexuality of the characters.
Oh yeah. Three of the characters are bisexual. There's two lesbians, a gay man, and the token straight.
Oh, the token straight. how hard is it to make the determination of the sexuality of each character? Do you set out to do that in advance, or do you let the story kind of tell you?
Well, I always knew I wanted to have Eliza and Silas as a unit, and then also have them have a boyfriend that they shared. That's a relationship that I recognize from people in my life.
Oh,
so
sure,
it isn't. And I also was interested in talking about lots of, you know, dirty laundry type stuff in the LGBTQ community, like the inherent misogyny to bisexual erasure, and how it's always like the woman who's like apparently screwing everything up, and like they always assume that the woman is actually secretly straight and the men are actually secretly gay because like, can't possibly be the other way. But I wanted to have these people who were like very comfortably like, yep, I like men and women, and these are relationships that I've had in the past, these are relationships that I have now, none of them diminish any of the others, and we're just gonna have fun.
Wow. So the relationships that they're having, none of them come at issue at any point, or if they do, it's not because of the sexuality of the characters. It's just because of just standard traditional, I'm going to guess, out of relationships, jealousy or anger.
Yeah. Yeah. There's
possessiveness.
Yes,
whatever.
Absolutely. There's a bit of that. There's sort of a mentor, mentee relationship between their boyfriend and, their friend who's the gay man. And he really, really disapproves that Dodie, this young German singer, is now with a woman. Like it doesn't make any sense, and like he thought that he thinks that it's a way of manipulating him, or like promising him a life of social acceptance. And they're all I also don't fault Kit. I love all my characters, and I don't fault him because he had to fight really hard to find who he was, so it makes sense that he would feel possessive over this young man that he really cares about, and sort of resent how this relationship has unfolded.
Wow. It sounds like there's a lot of humor in the show, too.
Oh, yes. Well, yes.
I think the kids say it this way, the tea is being served.
Oh, yes. There's a bit of, I hear that is what they say. There's a bit of tea.
Well,
it's mostly gin, but.
Exactly. I'm sorry, I'm 52, so I have to hear it all on the streets.
I'm 28, but I am a time traveler, so I don't know what any of this.
Well, you told me earlier that you were an alien.
Yes, so a bit.
You're an alien time traveler.
Yeah, alien time. Well, there's the only way, right?
I think you're my first alien time traveler.
Well,
on the show. Wow.
It's such a pleasure to be here.
How are rehearsals going for the show?
Really amazingly well. I had a reading of this play a year ago, and we just had the director and I just asked our friends to be in it, and everyone was really, really wonderful.
Cool.
But this time, pretty much no one except for one actress could come back. So we held auditions, and we were both pretty apprehensive because there's a... Modern acting is very naturalistic,
mm-hmm.
and these are people in a setting where they are performing themselves. Like, the characters are performing characters of themselves because they're at a party, and people don't party now the way they used to in the 20s. You know, you had like a party persona, and
right.
and so it was, we knew it was going to be difficult to find people who could play a character playing a character, you know, play a character playing themselves.
No, I totally get it.
Yeah, yeah. And so... We had auditions, and I'm really grateful that we were able to do that at all because we were successfully funded on Kickstarter, so
awesome.
We were able to like do the thing and do it right. But the cast we found is really amazing, and they've put up with all of my obsessive history lessons and and like geeky music. I mean, like, oh, this song from the 20s is about like queer people because of these like secret words in there, and like, oh, in this song you can, yeah.
Well, it's helpful for them.
Yeah, well, they're all really, really receptive to it, and
good.
I'm so grateful. And everyone's so funny too. Like, there are laugh lines in there that I did not know were laugh lines.
Isn't that amazing?
Oh, it's amazing. I
know,
love
it's so
it.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Like one guy, the line is, I don't know his plans for the evening, which is not funny, but the way he does it for some reason, it's like, it breaks me every time.
That's great. Cause I always tell everybody, you know, as writers, cause I'm a writer myself, mm-hmm. like, typically, I'm writing in my pajamas and on the bed in front of the TV,
mm-hmm.
and the world is being created in my head. So you don't really know what's funny until you have actors saying it in front of an audience.
Yeah,
even if the audience is the creative team at the time. And it's great. It's a great, wonderful surprise in your life.
It's wonderful.
I didn't think that was funny, and then you'll write something that you think is hilarious, and then it's like crickets.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That definitely happens. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is it. This is the line. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. Okay.
Yeah. And then it's
yep.
like silence and or yeah. But
my director even caught a pun that I didn't know I put in there. I don't want to spoil it because it's very good, but I'm going to say that because I didn't know it was there, but there's like apparently a penis joke in there that I had no idea that I put in there. And he's like, oh, this is a pun. And I was like, oh, it is? Oh my God, it is.
I know. I have a musical that's going on in Chicago right now.
Oh, cool.
And we had I brought the cast in for my regular Your Program Is Your Ticket show, and we talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
The writer, my co-writer and I, the cast is talking about all of these things and that they were finding in the show.
Yeah.
And we were like, oh yeah, of course
yeah.
we put that
yeah,
in.
Yeah, we did that.
Oh, yeah. How did you know? Wow.
Yeah.
Good job on finding that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's really cool. And that's like, God, that's what I wish for. Like, I hope that... I always think of writing as you are telling someone the shape of something that's behind a sheet, and you are only creating the shape that is being seen as the sheet rests against it, and the actors and the director are looking behind the sheet and telling you what the rest of the shape of the object is.
Trademark alert. Oh my gosh, that's a great theory. You need to trademark that or something.
Okay.
Copyright that. That's a wonderful theory. It's very true. And it sounds like you really aspire to this because it's a building process
mm-hmm.
more than anything.
Yeah.
You know, I think we, as writers, we write it and then we turn it over to a director. And then the director pulls all these cool things out of it that we didn't even know were there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then after that, it goes to the actors and they do the same thing. And I think, I know one of my biggest downfalls is getting out of the way of all of that. It's really, really hard because often we're asked to just sit in the audience while they're rehearsing and not say anything.
Yeah.
And just like, oh, I hope the director addresses that. I hope that in, you just have to have trust.
Yeah.
I know.
My director, we've known each other for like 12 years. We've known each other from high school back in California. Like, we've known each other forever.
What part of California?
Sonoma.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
We were lately on fire.
I know, right? Gosh.
You might have heard of my hometown. It was on fire.
Well, I lived in Southern California, so I'm very...
on fire.
Yeah, I remember standing on the lip of my jacuzzi and like turning 360 and going, there's fire everywhere.
Well... safe in here, I guess. It's already boiling. The water's already boiling, so we're good.
Just jump in the pool. Exactly.
Yeah. We've known each other for over 10 years, and so we both like love theater for similar reasons, and we both still have these impassioned conversations about like art and theater and the meaning of it all and what have you. So I know that if he does something to my play, I can trust him. He's got my back. 100%.
There's a reason, yeah.
Oh yeah, he's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, that's terrific. Tell us about your experience with Frigid Fest. How's that going?
So far so good. I mean, it mostly because I did my last play here as well. That was about Mary Bennett from Pride and Prejudice, and it was in this space, and I feel comfortable here. It feels like a place that I know. So it feels more like doing another show at the Crane than it does feel like a festival. You know? We're a little nervous about all the props because it is a very prop heavy show because I did this to myself.
Well, it's a party.
Yeah, it's a party. Can't you tell?
Right. So
yeah.
There are things going on. People in hands and stuff. Yeah. And moving around and drinks and stuff. So yeah.
But I trust that it'll all work out. And I've got a great stage manager. And I know that Crane's got my back.
I trust it too.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's going to be delightful. Can you please give our audiences your social media information for the show?
Oh, yes. So you can get tickets for that on the Crane Theater website. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Z for Zelma. I don't use Twitter very much. I should be better about that. But maybe by the time you follow me, I'll start writing more on Twitter. at Z for Zelma on Twitter and Instagram. And you can buy tickets for Can't You Tell on the Crane Theater website. We're performing the 17th through the 3rd at various intervals.
Sure.
Yeah, it's
festival style.
Right. Yeah. We would love to see you in the audience dressed up.
Dress like you're going to a party.
Yeah.
That would be good. You should do one night.
Well,
theme night party dress, everybody.
I know that all my personal friends, they dress like that anyway, so.
Well, that's good. Well, it's been delightful talking to you, Kelsey.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure entirely. Once again, Kelsey Herks from Can't You Tell. Break legs in the festival, and I'm going to do my absolute very best to come and see it. And until then, have fun.
Thank you so much. I'd love to see you in the audience.
Oh, good, 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 good. Folks, please welcome to the show Marissa Stafatos and Rafi Frungian from Upstander, Bystander, From Camp to Camp. Hi, Marissa and Rafi, and welcome to your program, Is Your Ticket.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having us here today. We're so excited to be here.
Oh, good. It's my pleasure. I'm glad you're excited. Thank you for your excitement. That's wonderful. Tell our audience about Upstander, Bystander, From Camp to Camp.
Okay. Upstander, Bystander, in a few words, is about making connections in a fractured world. It involves a Jewish concentration camp survivor, a German soldier, a German Nazi, and a refugee, who is our connection to today.
Wow. And is it a play? Is it a musical? Is it a play with music?
It's a play with music. And music plays a central role in this production. Actually, music is the other voice of many of the characters. For the refugee, the guitar and the oud is the other voice of this character. For the Jewish survivor, The violin is the other instrument, is the other sound. And for the Germans, the flute is the other sound, which the characters do play. The refugee doesn't play an instrument, yet Rafi Frunzian will be playing guitar throughout, and he will be underscoring and composing music for the piece.
Wow. So did you write book, Marissa, and Rafi, are you writing music and lyrics? Is that how the writing breaks down, or are the lines blurred a little bit?
The lines are blurred. The piece has been written by Laurence Boeck, originally in French. And I translated the piece from French to English, and then I adapted it as well for the stage. It was a piece that was already made for the stage, but we, in the evolution of the script and in terms of the rehearsals, it changed a little bit. And then also with adding the music, the piece shifted a little bit as well, which was very, very interesting, and it's continuing to do so as we speak.
Oh yeah, you're in rehearsal now.
Yes.
So it's evolving, which it should be. Rafi, talk about the music a little bit.
We've been rehearsing a little bit, and I've been just listening to the script a lot. And this play is great because it helps me come back a little bit to my Armenian background a little bit with for the Syrian refugee. I'm Armenian. There's a Middle Eastern undertone to some of the music that I play, so it helps me explore that a little bit.
Wow.
So I am going to be bringing in a little bit of this Armenian instrument called the oud. It's like a guitar. It's got a round back. It's got all these crazy designs on it.
Thank you. I was going to ask what that was.
Yeah, it's okay. Not a lot of people know what it is. But,
interesting.
But there will be a lot of guitar, and it's almost like I'm scoring a film a bit. There's parts that, the Jewish survivor will talk about how her family, what happened to her family, and I will just need to come up with a good music that would bring a good feeling about that.
Yeah.
Now, you said that you were bringing in your Armenian heritage influence into the music. Mm-hmm. Are there any other types of music or influences of music in the show?
Besides that, I'm a fingerstyle guitar player. What that means is I play the guitar with my fingers. I treat it almost like a piano, like the left hand on the piano and the right hand together. And I, this is where I mess up.
Well, no. And so is it that the, okay, this is just based upon the miming that he just did. Does that mean that the guitar is laying flat on a surface? And you're playing it with your fingers in that manner?
Yeah, and laying flat on the surface.
Because that sounds really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It does, and it's a different technique that we don't really see.
Yeah, it's not just merely strumming the guitar and just singing over it. I'm almost playing like classical guitar, essentially. And sometimes I'll be drumming on the guitar a little bit to create a mood if there's a buildup in the piece. I also utilize something called looping, where I'll record myself while I'm playing live, and I'll accompany myself, if that makes any sense at all.
Is that like when...
That's what Ed Sheeran does.
it reminds me of when, I forget the name of the show that was at Circle in the Square, where they did it all a cappella, and they had a gentleman who had a bunch of pedals on the floor.
Exactly.
Is that what that is?
Yeah. I have a pedal that records myself, and when I finish recording, it plays back what I'm playing. So if I'm drumming and recording that and finish the recording, I'll hear the drumming going in a circle. It'll be going the whole time, and then I'll play over the drumming with something else. So whether it's oud or a guitar or whatever instrument.
That's not just cool to listen to, but cool to watch. That's neat.
Yeah.
Now, Marissa, you say that you translated the play. The play was originally by a French playwright.
Yes.
And then you went in and translated
it. Yes.
So I would assume that you speak French?
Yes, I speak French.
Okay, and what were the challenges in translating the play from one language to another?
Well, some of the challenges were, of course, language, tone. Also, I would say I would say, you know, the way things were phrased, and also the arc, the character's arc, and the dramatic element, really making sure that the piece was action oriented. That also we're really kind of delving into the depths of humanity in this piece, so every word counts.
Right.
I really think of it as this as a piece of poetry, really, with music and, you know, acting. And I really think of it as poetry in motion. So what it's the words that are chosen are very, very important, and they're very, very powerful. So in the translation, that was part of my process, really being responsible for what really we're trying to evoke here, because we're really towing the line sometimes with some pretty intense material that addresses our humanity. Sure. And our responsibility as human beings. And it's such a powerful piece, and the more we work on it, I see that and I feel that. And in the rehearsal process too, there's some words that are changed or shifted because the actors have taken so much ownership of the piece.
Good.
That they seem slowly to be becoming a version of each of these characters. And then what's interesting is we see that evolve every rehearsal. There's a shift, there's a change, there's a nuance, there's a tone. There's also repetition. There's more repetition that I've added in terms of, and the actors have added, in terms of the script where, for instance, the German Nazi may utilize the same words as the Jewish survivor, yet they'll mean something completely different. For instance, this is when it all started. This is when it all began. For the German, that means something. That means the beginning of something wonderful, the beginning of this ideology.
Right.
But for the Jewish survivor, this is a threat to her life, a threat to her family, and eventually the death of her people.
Yeah, that's a pretty wide dichotomy.
Yes.
And then now, did you also have to consider the? I think each country's audience has its own psychology of what they expect when they walk into the theater. Did you have to consider the psychology of the American audience in your translation as
yes.
well?
Yes.
And what were the components that you had to consider and sort of make room for in your translation?
I did make room for a very open-minded society. We are living in a society where there are many, I think especially in New York City, we're living in a society which there are many cultures and there are many different perspectives and points of view than many other areas in the world, many mm-hmm. other countries.
Sure.
And we have a freedom to express ourselves that I think many times we take for granted.
Indeed.
And we also, because of that, we have the ability to enforce change. And I think there's really, in this country as well, the aspect of being fragmented and focusing so much on our differences and the polarizations, I think that's something that we really want to address in this piece, and being able to make those connections with each other. For instance, in terms of many of the conflicts that have come about in our political system, and many of the, you know, for instance, the Me Too movement, and the
right.
conflict about Trump being president, and really taking our power back as human beings,
mm-hmm.
and really having the ability to question, to really think on our feet, as opposed to being the peons of propaganda or of technology or the soundbite, really being thinking, feeling, educated human beings. And I don't mean educated in the hoity-toity way. I mean educated in terms of really knowing what's going on and questioning and having that sense of empowerment. That's what this play is about. It's about love and empowerment and really using one's mind and agency. Really, really, that's what we're focusing on.
Wow. That is a tall order.
Yes.
And I'm glad you're addressing it. That's terrific. It sounds like both of you have put so much thought, not just into the mechanics of what you need to do, but also the surrounding themes and narrative and how they're going to affect it. I just think that's absolutely terrific. How are rehearsals going?
Rehearsals are going very, very well. I would say they're very creative and collaborative rehearsals. Something new happens each time, each day that we have a rehearsal. The dimension seems to increase. For instance, today is the first day we had Rafi at our rehearsals, and we'd been talking for a very long time about it, and it went very beautifully in terms of integrating the drama with the music. We did a lot of that today. So that's something that we've been focusing a lot on recently. Also, there are moments where words aren't spoken, but tension builds, and that's something that we're working on a lot, is the idea of the use of motion and emotion as opposed to, let's say, just focusing on the words and then combining the musical aspect to really underscore that and to pronounce that even more. So that's where we're at. And I think we're at the point where we're really starting to blossom and come together now. That's where we are.
You haven't used this term yet, but to me it almost feels like a dance.
Yes.
And just the way you're talking about it, like there's a lot of inadvertent choreography going on. Not necessarily, you know, choreography of, you know, people doing dance steps on stage, but just movement.
Yes.
And a lyricism.
Yes.
And that's really cool.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you say that, because you just brought something about in me. One production that I was involved with a while ago was called Dance. It wasn't called Dance with Words, but it was called Narcisse, and it was by this woman who she directed it. Her name was Andenaise Tunney, and she recently passed. She was a director who I worked with very, very, very well, and the piece was called Narcisse.
What does that mean?
It means narcissist.
Ah, okay.
And it was at the Theater for the New City, but she created this. She had this concept which was called Dance with Words. And I feel like this, too, in a way, is a dance with words. And in a way, it's also a little bit of a tribute to her. She was a French woman who was extremely talented and a very free spirit. And part of this play, and I think doing this project, is a tribute to my mother, who was a big source of inspiration for me, and also this woman, who was extremely creative and very experimental in her approach, a big adventure in terms of her art and the use of art and language and music.
Wow. Yeah. How was your mother inspirational to you?
My mother, I would say my mother was my muse. My mother was someone who was an actress and a singer, a writer. She was an artist in every sense of the word. Mm-hmm. And my mother's the one who really gave me, I think, the writing, the acting, the musical, and directing bug. So ever since I was a child, I really started to question things.
And good.
Life for me was a creative experience, and theater for me is a sacred place, and so and the arts are as well, and so is music and dance. And I would play music since I was a child, and that was my respite. That was my place where I felt safe, and where I could create, and where I felt free in terms of that, and also in terms of the theater as well. That was my realm, and it was almost like always a sacred place for me. And that's the connection I had to my mother, who was always writing, and we would create pieces together. And she was very inspirational, and her background also is from Asia Minor, and her parents escaped. Her grandmother escaped from there, and her father also came from there in 1922. So I have a very deep connection to the idea of the refugee, and my mother did as well. There was always that feeling, that story wanting to kind of be expressed. So my mother is really, I would say, yeah, she's my muse.
That's great.
Yeah.
And Rafi,
mm-hmm.
What was your musical upbringing like? Were you introduced to music early on by your family, or is it something that you just went out and found yourself? Talk about that a little bit.
Very early. You know, I grew up in a house of artists as well. My mom is a graphic designer. My dad is a graphic designer. My sister's an actress. But we are Armenian. We're all artistic. We have a lot of Armenian percussion instruments that were just lying around in the house. And my mom has listened to enough music and knew it well enough to show me some really simple Armenian rhythms to play on a very small Armenian drum called the dumbek. And I played that for a while. I always had an interest in drums before the guitar came in. And I have a cousin also named Rafi, who plays the oud and the drums and everything, and a cousin named Shant. And they were the two that really, you know, whenever we would go to their house, it would just be music. We wouldn't even be playing, like, video games like most kids would. We would just be playing songs all day. But then eventually I picked up the cello, and then I picked up the guitar, and I just started playing in bands and been playing for a long time, so.
Wow. Yeah. And Marissa, you say that you have a music background as well.
Yes.
Is it as in-depth as Rafi's? Because I only ask that because I just wrote a musical, and my musical writing partner, he writes the lyrics and the music, and I write book. But I grew up playing the baritone horn for years. Oh. And so it's helpful with my lighter experience as being as a musician, I can call myself a musician, to be able to at least speak the language of music. Is that
yes,
your experience?
Yes.
As well?
Yes.
What was your musical experience like growing up specifically?
My musical experience growing up was I started from about 5 years old to play the piano, and I always wanted to play, even as a child. And the best gift I ever received was my piano, which I still own today. And I took lessons, and I was in concerts, and I started to compose my own music, which was, I really felt, was a direct channel to the spiritual. For me, that's something I think that connected me so much to the arts in so many ways. I mean, even think, you know, many times when I direct theater, I think of music, and this was and still continues to be something that I connect to, which is why in the piece, it just in almost every piece that I'm involved with, music has to be there, because I feel that in a way too, that's my other voice. That's wow. The voice, and so for each of the characters, just that letting go, and just that belief we all have to have as an artist, just the idea of, you know, relinquishing control and allowing the intuitive artistic aspect to take over. That's what happened. Also, that's what happens all the time with me as an artist. When I compose, I feel like it just comes from this place that you know, we don't have to control, that we can just allow to be and right. To tell a story. Mm-hmm. So that's why with each of these characters, I feel and I felt that the music tells part of the story and the side of themselves, and brings about a side of themselves that they don't express through words or can't express through words. And there's something also about music I'd like to add, is that music speaks to a part of us that is purely emotional and that can bring back memory.
Yeah.
And that is so important, I think, for people to be aware of.
It's very visceral, yeah.
It's very visceral. And even my mother actually had dementia when she passed. Mm-hmm. And music was a way to bring her back.
Wow.
And music that we had composed and created together, and musical pieces that she knew, and that we would dance to. The night before she passed, we actually danced together to music. Uh-huh. And this would jog her memory, and that's the connection that I really have to it, and also with this organization I'm involved with, where I do artistic programming for people who have dementia. We use music and drama therapy to really help heal people and create a better world, which is what I think we're also doing with this piece. It's really a piece about healing and about really reaching out to each other and connecting and moving past what we've fears and differences, and really looking to what really connects us.
Wow. Well, my co-writer always says on stage, when the characters The characters start singing when they can't talk about what they're talking about anymore. When they run out of things to say because it's just too difficult to say it, they will sing it. And in my opinion, I think music on stage cracks open the mind of the character and allows us to see their thoughts. And it's very internal. It's just a wonderful, lovely answer and a great story about your mom. Thank you for sharing that. We only have a few minutes left, so can you just tell our audiences what you want them to leave feeling or thinking about after they see Upstander, Bystander from Camp to Camp?
Okay. I would like people to leave with a sense of connecting to themselves, number one. Connecting to their inner selves, really listening to that little voice inside, connecting to the piece of to the piece of themselves that connects to art, connects to life, connects to will, agency, and connecting to each other, really looking past differences and really thinking about the beauty and the art of life and trying to forge connections and just really listening to that. To that inner voice, and really looking at the world today, and what they can do in it. And now a little story comes to mind, which is every one of us can do our little part.
Sure.
And we can do it in so many ways because each one of us is gifted, and that's the reason for this play and also this production company, which is called Colibri Productions, which means hummingbird in French. And this story has to do with a little bird who's the hummingbird, who has the fastest wings on the planet and has a fast-beating heart and is considered a very spiritual bird. But what happens is there's a little story about this bird when there's this huge forest fire and all the animals run out of the forest, they leave their homes, and they're kind of looking on by this lake. There's this little bird, little hummingbird, comes about and he starts to take a few sprinkles from the lake and sprinkles them over the forest. And all the animals start laughing. They're like, oh, are you nuts? You're crazy. What do you think you're doing? He goes, no, I'm not. He says, every one of us has to do our part. And that's what we're really doing here. That's what I want people to leave with. Because we're doing, this is what each one of us can do. And what we're doing in this play, each one of us is you know, bringing about our part, our piece of creativity that comes together to tell a story about love and about connecting and how much magic can come from that.
Wow. Even if it's just teaching your children to do that.
Yes.
That's big enough and probably one of the most important things we can do as human beings. Wow, that's such amazing, excellent meditations on your show and life itself. That's great. Wow, wonderful. Now give our audience your social media information for the show, please.
So our Facebook page, please check it out, is Upstander Bystander from Camp to Camp. Also we have www.upstanderbystander.com. Please check that out. You'll love what you find out about our cast and crew. Our dates are Friday, February 23rd at 5:10, Sunday, February 25th at 1:50, Tuesday, February 27th at 10:30, Wednesday, February 28th, 7:10, and Saturday, March 3rd at 5 p.m. at the Crane Theater. Please come join us. We'd love to see you.
Most definitely. Well, thank you for being with us, Marissa Stefatos and Rafi Frungian. I got it right?
You got it right.
All right, excellent. You were amazing interview subjects, and I've had a great time listening to you and hearing all of your theories, and I wish you broken legs, but not broken arms, because you have to play the guitar.
Yeah.
You have to play the guitar and the oud, right?
And the oud, too. Yeah, no broken arms or fingers.
No, legs. None of that. Just broken legs for you, too. You were terrific, and I'm so glad that you were on your program. It's your
thank
ticket.
Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
Thank you.
Weren't they amazing? Great interviews, and I just know you're going to enjoy the shows. So go see them. You can find information and tickets to all of the 2018 Frigid Festival shows at www.horsetrade.info. Once again, that's www.horsetrade.info. Again, I'd like to thank my guests, Zachary Stamp and Tony Stamp from Life in 60 Minutes, Kelsey Herx from Can't You Tell, and Marissa Stefatos and Rafi Frungian from Upstander Bystander from Camp to Camp. You can find more episodes of Your Program Is Your Ticket at facebook.com/yourprogramisyourticket. I'm on Twitter at programticket. The website is yourprogramisyourticket.com. Easy. I'm also on YouTube. Search me out by just typing in Your Program Is Your Ticket. Should come up. Some fun videos there. And I'm on iTunes and SoundCloud. Rate me and write me a review. Subscribe. All of those things just up my profile and make me really happy. Folks, take a little time to see a show this week, and don't forget to give a smaller show some love. There's lots of theater gems out there. Until our next show, good night, theater people, and curtain. Your program is your ticket. Your program is your ticket. Your program is your ticket.